Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It has been 50 years since China took direct control of Tibet. As far as the Chinese government is concerned, this was a case of liberation. But to the people of Tibet, those in Tibet and living around the world, and the people that are sympathetic to their cause, this was an invasion. And people continue to call for, at the very least, greater autonomy for Tibet, and there are many people who say that indeed Tibet should be independent. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about recent events in Tibet, this continuing conflict over Chinese rule, what it's meant for the people of Tibet, and also consider the chances for some kind of resolution. And our guest for the program is Carol McGranahan. She's a cultural anthropologist and historian who specializes in contemporary Tibet, and she teaches at University of Colorado at Boulder. She's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief, just so we can keep moving and get as many callers in as possible. But questions certainly are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that if it would be long-distance call for you, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor McGranahan, hello.
Hi, hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I think probably, to make sure that people maybe have some kind of background, can you just, I realize this, one could talk for a long time about what happened in March of 1959, mm-hmm. but essentially just to give people the basics about what indeed happened when the Chinese took over in 50 years ago.
Okay, well, they actually took over earlier than 59. So what happens is, go back another decade, 1949, the communists defeat the nationalists, so Mao Zedong defeats Chiang Kai-shek, and one of the first things that Mao says he wants to do is take Tibet. And he was true to his word. He sent his troops into eastern Tibet in 49, and 1950, they marched all the way to Lhasa, to the capital of Tibet. And then in 1951, the Chinese government and the Tibetan government signed what's called the 17-point agreement. And the Tibetan government later denounced this and said, you know, it was signed under duress. We didn't really sign this. But they did try to make it work. So actually, it was from 1951 on that China was, you know, in Lhasa as a governmental presence. And for the first couple of years, the Tibetans really tried to cooperate and make things work, and the situation just degenerated as communist and socialist reforms were introduced, and these were social and political and economic, kind of all wrapped into one, trying to just immediately jumpstart Tibetan society into a socialist society. And as you might imagine, Tibetans responded very unhappily to this. And by 1959, the situation had gotten so bad that Tibetans rose up. Actually, uprisings had started earlier, had started in the mid-50s in eastern Tibet, but by 1959 in the capital in Lhasa, it got so bad that Tibetans took to the streets to defend the Dalai Lama, believing that the Chinese were threatening him, and on March 10th marks the day of the official Tibetan uprising, although the uprising really is something that lasted for several years, but this one day is the one that we focus on, because what happened on March 10th is the people took to the streets and then the Dalai Lama escaped, and escaped on foot in disguise from Lhasa, traveling down over the course of several weeks to the border of India, and then crossed over officially into exile in India, thinking he might be there for a couple months or a year, and, you know, now here we are 50 years later.
Yeah, he has not been back to Tibet since.
Has not been back to Tibet, and in fact, he's actually in Boston today, so quite far from Tibet at the moment.
For the Chinese, and communist Chinese managed to take over in 1949, that one of the first things that Mao Zedong said was that he wanted to take and hold Tibet. Mm-hmm. And now, certainly for China, there are they have certain kinds of claims, I'm sure, on this territory, and also there are security concerns here because Tibet occupies a position in between China and India, and mm-hmm. China certainly has. They have their security concerns about India. Was that really what this was about? Was it a a part of the idea of territorial security, or was there something more to it than that?
I think it's a number of things wrapped into one. So everything you mentioned is a component. There's absolutely an element of territorial security. By having Tibet as part of the PRC, that gives China a shared border with India, which is incredibly strategic and something they didn't have before. Tibet also, however, geographically is vast, and people often don't realize this, but Tibet comprises one-fifth of China's landmass. So China expanded, you know, kind of geographically exponentially by taking Tibet in. And Tibet is a vast but, you know, really mostly unpopulated terrain. So it's been a terrain that the Chinese have been able to use for military purposes, for nuclear testing purposes, and also for mineral, you know, and resource extraction. So there's that component as well, which is tied into the security but also slightly different. It's just a kind of classic Chinese empire building that fits, you know, a pattern we've seen over, you know, thousands of years with the Chinese. But then there's also an element, two kind of cultural political elements that are a bit separate from the security. There's, you know, the sense, the very genuine in some ways socialist sense that it did exist in the 1940s and the 1950s, that we need to bring socialism to the world and that this is a gift we're going to bestow upon our neighbors. So that was a new element, but what it was paired with was a very long-standing Han Chinese sense that almost a sense of what you might call colonial benevolence. That if we can bring the civilizing mission, you know, of Chinese culture to our neighbors, that is one of the, you know, the most gracious things we can do to non-Chinese peoples, is to allow them to enter, you know, into our cultural world. So there's an element of Chinese nationalism tied up with elements of, you know, socialist ideas of, you know, spreading socialist practices to the rest of the world, along with security, along with environmental issues, along with just general let's expand China as a political goal.
If the official position of the Chinese, what they say is that Tibet was a feudal society, and then, as I said in the beginning, they consider what they did was a liberation. And in fact, now they have marked this particular day, I think it's the 28th of March. This is now what they're calling Serfs Liberation Day.
Perfect.
So that's what they say is that as far as they're concerned, what they did was a good thing as far as the welfare of your average Tibetan is concerned.
Exactly. And that's where you see that socialist rhetoric kind of kicked back into high gear. We haven't seen it for several decades, you know, kind of with the economic opening of China. So Serf Liberation Day just debuted this year, and it's kind of the throwback in some ways to the, you know, 50s and 60s. But that's exactly what it is. And Chinese claims to Tibet over the last 50 years have shifted. They haven't always, you know, been consistent. And so this rhetoric that we're liberating, you know, the serfs and taking Tibetans out of a feudal period and bringing them into a modern socialist period was a specific rhetoric back then that's being a little bit revitalized now. But the thing that they've moved towards has been historic claims to Tibet. And it's interesting, although they're staking historic claims now, they actually weren't the claims they were making in the first half of their occupation of Tibet. So I think it's important to always kind of have this, you know, a sense that what they're saying now, what anyone is saying now, right, might be on a historically shifting terrain responding to the politics of the moment.
Last year in March, there was a lot of violence. There were violent protests. There were a lot of people killed. Just give us again the brief rundown of March of last year and what happened.
Sure. So what happened last year is that we saw the most widespread and most kind of the largest in terms of actual numbers of participants protest that we had seen in Tibet since 1959. So this was this was important on many levels, but often protests that have taken place in the last 20 years, basically since 1987 until the present, have been monks or nuns. So people who have considered themselves to be disaggregated or cut off a bit from their families in the sense that they felt they could act as autonomous actors and their families wouldn't be punished. So monks and nuns had somehow taken on the role for rest of Tibetans as, you know, the protesters, the ones who were going to be the public face of it. What we saw last year was a move away from that that's really important, because what we saw were people throughout Tibet protesting, farmers, nomads, business people, students, you know, housewives, old people, young people, men, women, you know, and yes, monks and nuns, but also it really reflected, you know, just Tibetans across all the different social occupations that you might find in the country. What were they responding to? A number of things. certainly political issues, you know, with the Olympics coming and also with the 50th anniversary on its way. There was that. Also economic issues, you know, considering just how developed we're now seeing the eastern seaboard of China and the huge gaps that are, you know, that are rising between eastern China and the western provinces. You know, I think a McDonald's opens up in Beijing, you know, new one every week practically. And Tibet's still very much very, very low socioeconomic, you know, indices, very low rates of education. All of those sorts of, you know, indices are very low in comparison, you know, to the rest of the country. But at its heart, what I would say that what was going on was not just saying, you know, we want to be more developed or we want, you know, economic parity with Beijing or Shanghai or Guangzhou. But really, we're still mad. We're not happy with the political system. We're not happy with the fact that the Dalai Lama is in exile. You know, we have a historical and political grudge, and our rights, you know, as Tibetans and as citizens of China are just not being met.
And then this year, on the important day, the 50th anniversary, it seemed pretty clear that the Chinese wanted to do everything they could to make sure that nothing like what happened last year happened this year.
Absolutely. You know, in some ways, which is probably why the Tibetans decided to rise up last year, you know, and kind of seize that opportunity, you know, under the little bit under the radar temporarily. But this year, yes. And everyone kind of, I think the whole world was on anticipation going, oh my, what's going to happen on March 10th, 2009? And the Chinese pretty much made sure, well, two things. One, that nothing major happened. And two, that any of the small protests that happened, just no information about them got out. So there have been protests that are ongoing. And as I tell my students here in Colorado, protests are happening in Tibet every day. You're just not hearing about them. They're just not being reported. And, you know, and anyone who, you know, does want to play around on the internet and, you know, go to all the various Tibet sites, you know, you can find information about what is happening and, you know, about a protest that just took place yesterday or about a, you know, a monk whose sentence was just, you know, given down. But it's not really being reported in the mainstream, you know, news media on a regular basis.
Our guest,
the sporadic protests are absolutely still happening today.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Carol McGranahan. She's a cultural anthropologist and historian, and she specializes in contemporary Tibet. She teaches at University of Colorado at Boulder, and we're talking about Tibet, and questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What if we did a survey of Tibetan people, not only people who are ethnically Tibetan, who live in Tibet and perhaps elsewhere in the PRC, mm-hmm. And perhaps also we could talk with people who live in Dharamsala and Tibetans who live in the United States and all over, and tried to do a good sampling and said, what is it that you really want here, or maybe not what do you really want, but of the politically possible, what would you say? And could you accept continuing relationship with China as long as there was significant autonomy? Or would there be a lot of people who would continue to say that what they really want and what they would want to hold out for would be Tibetan independence?
Well, it's interesting. There's two answers to this question. One is the Dalai Lama's take, of course, which is that the Dalai Lama has and has been saying for a very long time now, since 1987, that he is willing to work with the Chinese, that what he wants is meaningful and genuine autonomy for Tibet as a part of China. And so in some ways he's taken, you know, what you might consider a realist approach, although the Chinese never really want to engage him on this. But this is his official stance, that what we are seeking is not independence but is autonomy. The Tibetan people, what they want is two things, and here's where it gets complicated in the ways that, you know, people's real lives are complicated. Tibetans want what His Holiness wants, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And so if he says we want autonomy, then most Tibetans are going to say, yes, yes, we want what the Dalai Lama wants. But as a colleague of mine, actually, Elliot Sperling, who teaches at Indiana University, is known for saying, he's never been to a Tibet protest march where anyone is holding up a sign that says autonomy for Tibet, right? Mm-hmm. You go to a protest march, all Tibetans are there with signs that say free Tibet, China out of Tibet, UN, pay attention to Tibet. These are the sort of signs and messages that Tibetans have. So while they want to respect and listen to the Dalai Lama, in their heart of hearts, what they want is for the Dalai Lama to be back in Tibet and for Tibet to be under some form of Tibetan rule, you know, preferably an independent Tibetan rule. So the answer is somewhat complicated, and here's why. I think that, you know, the Chinese government often says, well, yeah, the Dalai Lama is not sincere. Well, the Dalai Lama is sincere. But for the Tibetan people, I think stomaching autonomy over independence is a bit harder than it is for someone like the Dalai Lama.
Well, and there have been, in recent years, there have been some talks between the government of China and the Tibetan government in exile. But it seems that there's a problem here because the Chinese continue to say, as you have said, that the Dalai Lama is not sincere in talking about autonomy. What he really wants is independence. And so they continue to say, well, we really can't deal with this guy. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the analysis says that what the Chinese are really doing is that they can just keep this, in a sense, at this kind of stalemate, and that they're willing to wait until the Dalai Lama passes, and then there will be the question of who will next emerge as the leader of the Tibetan mm-hmm. community, and what happens then. They could certainly name someone, but that person wouldn't be accepted by the Tibetans. It just seems like there's really not much of any place for all of this to go.
Absolutely. So dialogues between the Tibetans and the Chinese took place in the 1970s and early 1980s, and then were suspended for about 20 years. They started up again in 2002. So from 2002 until the present day, there have been 9 meetings between them, which is actually quite a high number when you stop to think about it, given that they were suspended for 20 years. But what's happened is that Tibetans basically feel nothing has come from them. And the Dalai Lama, at the conclusion of, so the Dalai Lama himself doesn't go, but sends his envoys, is getting increasingly frustrated, and publicly speaking out, saying, you know, we have done everything we can, and the Chinese are just not responding. So the idea that the Chinese are really waiting for the Dalai Lama to pass away, you know, is one that seems, you know, that just seems to be somewhat what they might be doing. And I fall on the side of those analysts who really think that's the wrong strategy. The only thing that is holding the Tibetan community together right now is the Dalai Lama. And, you know, once the Dalai Lama does pass away, then there is not going to be that same sort of glue that holds them together. You know, the Dalai Lama is not an elected leader. You know, he is the sort of leader that's really unparalleled in much of the rest of the world. He has the ability to hold Tibetans together because of their religious, you know, devotion to him and belief in him, not just as an institution, but as an actual deity, you know, as a reincarnate deity. So when he does pass away, you know, who will take up that role? It's hard to say. The Chinese have been maneuvering, you know, to say that we are the ones who will be appointing the Dalai Lama. And, you know, I wouldn't be the first to point out the kind of how ludicrous it is to think that a communist government would be the one, you know, to step into a religious matter like this and to say that they have the authority to appoint the highest, you know, person in Tibetan Buddhism. But basically, even if they do that, you're correct to say that Tibetans won't accept that person, you know. Should Tibetans, which I presume they will do, find a Dalai Lama, the problem is the Dalai Lama is found as a very young boy, you know, so would be probably a young boy between the ages of probably 2 and 5. And it would be another 2 decades before that child reached his, what they call the majority, when he could actually assume the political and the religious powers, you know, of the office of the Dalai Lama. So there's a long period there that's going to be very tenuous, and it would be in China's best interest to actually negotiate something now with the living Dalai Lama.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's talk with him. Someone in Urbana, line one.
Morning. Would you comment on how the extensive business and financial involvement of the United States corporations as well as government with China influences how the United States may be a positive force to promote the Tibetan agenda, political agenda with China. It seems that the extent of monetary interests in the United States right now with China and the indebtedness of the United States to China mm-hmm. almost precludes the United States having a forceful role to advance the political agenda of Tibet, which I think would be a very negative consequence of that involvement.
Mm-hmm. a tough one. There are people who fall on both sides of this issue, you know, and I'm thinking all the way back to the Clinton years when the whole question of what was going to be linked to most favored nation's trade status for China, you know, what sort of human rights requirements or, you know, limits were going to be put on that. People fall on both lines of this. So what do we do in terms of trade and business with China, you know, given the vast volume of business that is conducted between the two countries? Just for the record, the Dalai Lama strongly believes that there should be no sort of sanctions or boycotts. So he's always speaking out against those, and he believes that engagement, including in the economic business world as well as in the political world, is the way to go. I think that said, there's a lot more that U.S. businesses could do. And it's groups like Students for a Free Tibet, who I think are the ones that are really kind of pushing the buttons and trying to get corporations to think more strongly about what does it mean to be conducting business in China? What does it mean to be, you know, up front and center about human rights questions when you're, you know, conducting business there? I'm trying to think. Hillary Clinton was one of her first visits, right, as Secretary of State, was to China. And she actually did not put human rights on the agenda. And this was probably one of the first criticisms of the Obama administration by many people, was the decision, you know, of the State Department and presumably of the White House, you know, in this first meeting with China, to do what they could to pave the way very smoothly, you know, for business and diplomatic interests. So I think I'd follow with you that there's much more work that needs to be done. But I'm not exactly sure what, when, if sanctions and boycotts are not the way to go, and, you know, building things in without being patronizing or patriarchal, but really finding ways that are going to be effective. I think it's going to fall to groups like Students for a Free Tibet to really be the ones to come up with creative solutions for that.
Do you know whether China has been pushing back because of their extensive financial position now with the United States, that the United States actually minimizes its involvement in advancing Tibetan concerns?
Well, I think you're onto something there. If you travel to China and you're in any of these eastern seaboard cities, there is a great sense of real economic hubris almost. You know, there is a sense of things happening and that we are going places. And it's on a global scale. It's not just on a national scale. So definitely I would say that the tone with which the Chinese government is now negotiating with the rest of the world and not just the U.S., you know, has been ramped up. And we see that, for example, in how they deal with human rights. Their stance used to be that we have different human rights. You know, Western universal human rights are for the rest of the world, and the human rights we have in China are Chinese human rights. Well, in the last 5 years, they realized that rhetoric, you know, just didn't work anymore. And now they've changed it to, no, we have human rights that are the same as the rest of the world. And so they have really, even just at that level, been working to level the playing field so that when they step into, you know, rooms of negotiations, they don't have to speak from, you know, the China square, but saying, no, we are on the same playing field in terms of the discourse and the rhetoric, you know, and the ideas with which, you know, everyone is operating. So they're really coming from a different position these days, and I think it's a position of strength.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Carol McGranahan. She's a cultural anthropologist and historian. She specializes in contemporary Tibet. She teaches at University of Colorado at Boulder. And we are talking about Tibet. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things I'm interested in having you talk some more about is how perhaps the attitudes of Tibetans and what they would like to see happen with their country in regards to China break down along generational lines, in the sense that I am sure that all Tibetans have a very high degree of regard and reverence for the person of the Dalai Lama. Having said that, though, I think that it is also true that particularly younger people can be a bit impatient and, in fact, have been somewhat critical of his policy of trying to take this middle road of not being really aggressive, and that I think that there are certainly some younger Tibetans who think that a little bit more aggression and might be in order. And I think that's also one of the reasons why some people say the Chinese would be much smarter to try to deal with him now and the situation now as opposed to sometime in the future when there maybe isn't such a strong central figure and we have more and more younger people who might be interested in just pushing this a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this is one of the things I was trying to intimate earlier, that it was exactly this, the ability to control or curtail any potential violence. Just one thought, though, is that these alternative voices have always been there. So there have always been people in the Tibetan exile community, and I believe in Tibet itself, who have had alternative thoughts and alternative plans. I think the thing is that right now in this age of the Internet and Web 2.0 and just all the various ways that we can communicate beyond just our face-to-face daily communities, we're more aware of these people. But, for example, there were Tibetans in South India in the early 80s who were doing their own guerrilla training separate of the Tibetan government. So I'm not sure how new it is. And it's not just the young people, but there's a new sense among young people that through the Internet there is a new platform to speak and to really articulate what it is you want to the world. There's also a real difference in terms of education. So this is what has been one of the major accomplishments of the Tibetan community in exile, is that pretty much every single child, has received a secular education. And so this is now a highly educated, highly literate community, which ironically was built out of a incredibly uneducated and mostly illiterate community. So I think also just the empowerment that comes from education, we're seeing that as well in terms of the ability to publicly express oneself. For Tibetans living in China, of course, there's not the same opportunities for public expression that we see in exile, but I think there's a lot of the same sentiment was expressed last year, in the protests. That, and again, these were across generations, so they weren't just the youth. So the youth are the ones who will be, leading the way in the future, but I actually would say that it's not just the youth who have some of these ideas.
One of the things that the Chinese have done as a matter of deliberate policy is that they have moved people who are ethnically Chinese, Han Chinese, into Tibet.
Right.
And then the argument has been made that what the Chinese were trying to do is, in a sense, dilute the influence and the culture of the indigenous people of Tibet by literally making them a minority in their own country. And I think that there is a concern that if these kinds of demographic trends continue, that actually would happen. What can you actually say something about currently what the population of Tibet looks like, and what are the numbers, relative numbers of Tibetans versus people who are ethnically Chinese who were moved there from some other part of China?
Well, I would love to be able to give you numbers, but the Chinese government doesn't release any that are actually really worth talking about. So we actually do not have great demographic numbers for what the respective populations look like, whether it's Tibetan, Han Chinese, the Hui Muslims, or anyone else. And one of the reasons is that they only count specific people in the census. So, for example, all of the military is excluded. So you just get a very skewed look at it. Okay, but to go back from that, the resettlement project, so the moving of Chinese to various areas in Tibet, is something that's been a little bit hard to talk about for most scholars, because some portions of it tend to be official and some portions of it tend to be unofficial. But one thing that we do know is that there are definitely incentives that are given, to anyone who moves to a place in Tibet, opens a business, kind of relocates there. There's definitely subsidies that the government, will give to those individuals. So, nowadays, if you go to Lhasa, what you see is that the Lhasa, the Tibetan part of the city, is now just a neighborhood practically. And there are other places where you can be standing and it feels like you could be in, if you didn't look or if you can't see the surrounding landscape, you could be practically anywhere in China. And so it's just very visceral and visible in that sense when you're just standing there that, wow, the Chinese population has really, really grown. This is presuming that you have been there before. But in even rural areas, what we're seeing now is that, even small Tibetan towns will have some Chinese family that's moved in and has opened up a shop, a restaurant. There are prostitutes now, throughout Tibet, kind of tied to where the military bases are. And these are Chinese, also some Tibetan. But so it's gendered in a sense as well, that women are coming specifically to service the military. And then there are families or just men coming. So it's there, it's tangible, it's hard to give the numbers for, though, because of the way that the Chinese government counts their people or not.
Are there other things that China has done also as a something, what you would have to say would be a deliberate matter of policy to try to discourage or maybe even extinguish Tibetan culture, religion, language, things like that?
There's all sorts of things. For example, in the education system, there are two separate streams of education, and one is the Chinese language medium and one is the Tibetan language medium. And, you know, Tibetans, many of them want their children to study in Tibetan, but should you choose to do that, then the job opportunities you have are basically, you know, null once you've graduated. To go in the Chinese stream, however, doesn't necessarily guarantee you a job because Tibetans seem to find that upon graduating that the jobs go to, you know, Han Chinese anyways. So that has been a problem in trying to figure out how to best navigate the language and education system. Some of the places where the most serious and even egregious changes have taken place, however, in the domain of religion, you know, and the ability to freely practice one's religion. You know, at the moment, just to give an example, perhaps the most famous example, you know, it's illegal for a Tibetan to have an image of the Dalai Lama, a photograph of the Dalai Lama. And that might seem like not a big deal, but when you consider that Tibetan prayer and worship involves the use of images and the meditation upon them, it's actually a very big deal. So there's things like that where the state has just absolutely insinuated itself between the Tibetans and their cultural practices and has disrupted them on massive levels that affect everyone from small children, you know, all the way on up to older people.
So, and I guess I'm thinking, I'll just going back to the general question of how Tibetans, how indigenous Tibetan people are doing, that the Chinese on the one hand, I'm sure that they would make claims about how they're improving the country, they're modernizing the country, that lives of people are better and so forth. However, it seems that the fairly consistent complaint all along of Tibetans has been, no, in fact, that the Tibetans are, we're treated as second-class citizens. We haven't enjoyed the benefits of economic development that the Chinese have, certainly not that they have in other parts of the country, that we're increasingly marginalized, that the Han Chinese, the ethnic Chinese, they get the best jobs, they have the best opportunities, and that, in fact, there is not equality between us and between us and the Chinese.
Definitely. I think there's kind of two components to your answer. And so to follow with what you were just saying, there's definitely that sense that Tibetans are second-class citizens. And this is something I would say that they probably share with some other what are considered minority nationalities within China. You know, that to have that status, it's about a Minzu status in China, it's not a prestigious, favorable status at all. You know, it's one that connotes a sense of being backward, of being someone who's in need of, you know, work and civilization and to just be second class in general. But the first kind of to add on to that, is the sense of the, you know, there's one of the things that the Chinese do say, and again, this is straight out of the colonialist, you know, imperialist playbook, is, well, we developed Tibet, or, you know, we brought education, we brought electricity, we brought roads to Tibet. You know, and the underlying presumption there is that the Tibetans wouldn't have done this themselves. Well, of course they would have. You know, in 1949, 1950, there were sure lots of places in the world that didn't yet have electricity in every home, you know, that didn't have a secular education system that was nationwide. You know, these were things that Tibet and many other places were working toward. So to say that these wouldn't have happened, which is kind of the insinuation that the Chinese government makes, is, you know, is problematic.
Let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I would think that China would be a great place, Tibet would be a great place for a tourist attraction, but obviously the Chinese domination and assimilation definitely pollutes that. What are the cross currents or motivations that eliminate that possibility of a great tourist attraction and a great source of revenue?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, Tibet's far. it's far away, so it's difficult to get there. So that brings, you know, down the ability of people to travel there, you know, right from off the bat. But it's a difficult place to travel to, not just logistically and practically, but emotionally, I find. I do a lot of work in Nepal and the Himalayas as well, and what I often say to people is, when I'm in Nepal, I feel wonderful, but there's a lot of health issues there that are different. When I go to Tibet, my health issues go, they disappear, but my heart feels heavy. there's a sense, you get a tangible sense that this is a place of oppression. This is a place where people live, you know, with one eye, you know, looking over their shoulder as they walk down the street. And you can sense that even as a tourist. So Tibet might be a place of, you know, incredible scenic vistas. The geographic beauty, you know, of being on the roof of the world is absolutely stunning. And you will have experiences, perhaps, in Tibetan monasteries that will blow your mind. The scale of the building, that you feel the depth and the passion of the religion and the culture, even under the oppression. But then just having that sense, especially for someone, you know, coming from the U.S., where we tend not to feel that, you know, in our life. And it can be really disturbing, you know, to tourists. And tourists can have a tough time trying, you know, to come to terms with this and to really make sense of it in, you know, just a short visit to a place like Tibet.
Thank you.
All right. And I do understand that after having it, because of the Chinese concern about these important anniversaries and what had happened then a year ago, that within the past couple of months, it had been closed, and yet now things have opened up again, at least earlier this month, things opened up again, and there were people going there. I don't know what sort of numbers we're talking about, but indeed there were people going there from Europe and also from Japan and from the United States and other places. So as part of organized tours, I suppose it's also the thing that has to be said is that that the Chinese don't make it easy to go there, and that I'm sure that you have to get various kinds of official permissions, and they would like people to be part of some sort of manageable group so they can keep an eye on everybody.
Right. So the Chinese control tourism to Tibet very strictly, and they change the rules frequently. It gets open and closed, you know, at the drop of a hat. If some big Chinese holiday is coming up, a national holiday, they'll just close Tibet and say no one can go there. What people should know, though, is if you do want to go to Tibet, the way it usually works when Tibet is open and when, you know, the political situation is somewhat stable, is that you do need to go in on an official tour, but once your tour has ended, you are allowed to stay. So say you're going in from Kathmandu and you've booked a 3-day tour. Once that tour is finished, you can usually stay for another week, month or two if you want. So it's hard to say, though. Tibet is one of those places where what you say today could entirely change tomorrow. And one of the best places, you know, for up-to-date live information of this is, you know, to try and get online and find information from other travelers who are actually there now. The Lonely Planet website is a great source of information.
Are there particular challenges for somebody like you who goes there as a scholar?
Absolutely. And especially given what happened last year, most scholars were kicked out. I believe there was only one who was allowed to remain. But yes, so for scholars, we are immediately, you know, one of the groups who the Chinese government would immediately turn their eye to and say, you're out of here. You know, time to get them all out, so that nothing we don't want to be seen is seen or heard. But for me, especially given the very political nature of my research, it would be very difficult for me to do certain types of research in Tibet, not because of jeopardizing myself, but because of jeopardizing, you know, the Tibetan people with whom I would want to be talking. So, yes, there's always, you know, very heightened political stakes involved in conducting research in Tibet. And that's, you know, I'm a historian of politics and scholar of politics, but even I have a friend who is a, you know, biologist who studies yak behavior, and even her research is considered political.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Carol McGranahan. She's a cultural anthropologist at University of Colorado Boulder. She's a historian. She specializes in contemporary Tibet, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly the issue of Tibet is one that has gotten a lot of attention around the world, and that's been helped because people of note have taken this on as something that they think is important. And for the people of Tibet, they're fortunate enough to have in the person of the Dalai Lama someone who is very charismatic and very appealing, and does a wonderful job of presenting Tibet, Tibetan culture, Tibetan religion, and to talk about his country. So certainly it's the kind of thing that has a fairly high profile in world media. One wonders, do the Chinese care particularly? I'm sure on one level that they do. They don't like getting negative press. But whether in fact that they care enough to actually want to do anything about that or to change their policy.
I think they care very much, actually. And whenever the Dalai Lama is scheduled to meet with a head of state or even a parliamentary body, the Chinese government issues statements, you know, to that country saying that, you know, sometimes they even go as far as we forbid, we don't want you, not just we ask you not to, but, you know, if you meet with the Dalai Lama, this will have a negative effect on the relationship between China and Germany, China and the U.S., China and the U.K., you know, wherever it happens to be. So they actually respond very strongly. I guess it's public-private in some ways, a difference between the actual PR work that the Dalai Lama does around the world versus the Chinese don't quite launch a PR effort to kind of counter that in the same way. But the Dalai Lama's global presence is not just organic. It seems it in some ways. But it started really in the late 1980s when the Tibetans realized, you know, we thought that just the truth of our cause and the righteousness of our cause was going to be sufficient. And we're really finally realizing that it wasn't and said, you know, we need to reach out not just to, you know, state leaders, but to people around the world and kind of appeal to them. And they launched a global campaign. 1991 was the International Year of Tibet. And, you know, for folks like myself, and you can maybe think back and date, it was right around the time that the rainforest was big. When this was all happening, and that's when Tibet burst onto the scene. And if you think, okay, well, what was I doing in, you know, the 80s? No one really knew much about Tibet then. But since then, it's been very prominent, and this has been something that the Tibetans have consciously done, have consciously said, we need to reach out to the rest of the world because it's not happening on its own.
Has any you talked about the fact that when it's announced that some world leader could be the British Prime Minister, or the President of France, or Germany, or the President of the United States, or people like that, if it is announced that they're going to meet with the Dalai Lama, that, as you say, the government of China gets kind of worked up and says, no, we don't do that. We really don't want you to do that. Has any world leader actually ever canceled a meeting with the Dalai Lama because the Chinese said, we're very upset about this?
Oh, God. Well, we just had a huge issue in South Africa. I don't know if you heard about this. This happened a month ago. But there was going to be, I don't want to get all the facts wrong, it was, I think, a soccer tournament was going to take place, like a kind of soccer tournament bringing together teams from various countries. And simultaneously with this, they were going to have a meeting of formal Nobel Peace Prize laureates, of which the Dalai Lama is one. He got the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989. And the South African government denied his visa request. And very definitely.
Now that you mention it, I guess I do recall that, yes.
Yeah. So this is the most recent. And there was uproar and outrage and all sorts of, protests going on. But ultimately it stood. And, you know, we just had elections and we'll see what Zuma does now. But the event was canceled, and not just the Dalai Lama, but none of the Nobel, Peace Prize laureates ended up going or attending at all.
I suppose that says something, has something to say about in recent years, the effort of the Chinese to build relationships with governments in Africa by spending a great deal of money and doing a lot of development work on the continent.
Yes. No, this is one of the things that I think the world has not fully woken up to yet, or at least some of us over in North America haven't yet. But just the way that China, and again, this is think of it in imperial terms and Chinese, it's the 1,000-year plan, not the 5-year plan. But very much so the Chinese influence in Africa has really grown lately.
Yeah. Well, again, we have maybe now about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. If somebody had a question, they wanted to get it in, there certainly is time. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Carol McGranahan. She's a professor at University of Colorado Boulder. She's an historian. She specializes in contemporary Tibet, and questions are certainly welcome. We just to return to something I'm not sure if we may have exhausted the topic, but I guess I'm continued to be interested in in what happens now in the future in terms of the leadership within the Tibetan community. And again, we wish the Dalai Lama well,
exactly,
but he's not a young man, so we know that as is the way of all things, one of these days he will move on along the circle, and Then the question is, well, you know, who emerges to lead the community, even if a new Lama is named, new Dalai Lama is named, as you said, he's going to be a young boy, and it's going to be a long time before he himself would be ready to step into that role. What sort of people are there? There certainly must be other people who are significant in the leadership of the exile Tibetan exile community who would be the ones who would be running things until and if the day came that there would be a new Dalai Lama who could take that on.
Absolutely. And, of course, the Tibetans have a system for this because the current Dalai Lama is the 14th, so they've been through this 13, you know, ostensibly times before when they've had to deal with the fact that the Dalai Lama is a young boy and not ready yet. And so what they do is a system called the regent system. And they have either one or two regents who serve as basically the caretakers of the country while the Dalai Lama is a minor. And there are a couple people who would probably be strong candidates for that. One, of course, would be the Karmapa. The Karmapa is that, so there are a number of different sects, S-E-C-T, in Tibetan Buddhism, and the Dalai Lama is from the Gelugpa sect. The Karmapa is the head of the Kagyu sect. And the current Karmapa escaped from Tibet in the first part of the 21st century, so just recently escaped and has been in exile for a long time and is very respected and very revered and also has a lot of political cachet because he escaped. And at the time of his escape, the Chinese actually considered him to be one of their more successful, you know, kind of converts to a socialist way of thinking among Tibetan Buddhist leaders. So a very astute and worldly and politically savvy young man. He is currently, I want to say, he's in his late 20s now. The other contenders, potentially, would be the Dalai Lama's special envoy to Washington, D.C., but he has been the Dalai Lama's lead negotiator since 2002 on all 9 of the negotiating trips, and his name is Lodi Gyari. He's based in Washington, D.C., at the International Campaign for Tibet. Samdong Rinpoche is currently the chairman of the Tibetan parliament, so he might be another person who might be. So there's just three people, I guess, kind of right off the top of my head, who would probably be contenders for the position of regent if that was how the Tibetans decided to continue, to go with tradition, you know, and what the policy has been in the past.
As far as you know, has the Obama administration said anything in particular about Tibet that's really that substantially different from what previous administrations have said?
No. Not to my knowledge yet, but I'm holding on to hope that they will. I mean, he hasn't said anything negative, with the exception, as I was saying, of the Hillary Clinton visit and I think of a lot of general disappointment of people that human rights was not really raised. But no, I mean, I think President Obama, you know, gets it that Tibet is an issue and understands why, but he hasn't, to my knowledge, gone beyond anything that Bush or Clinton, either Bush, actually, Bush 1 or Bush 2, or Clinton had said.
We talked a little bit earlier about the significance of Tibet to China, and that it operates on a number of levels. Part of it is the idea that you want to keep and hold as much territory as you possibly can. There might be indeed some reasons why, even though this is a rough and difficult place to live, it has certain resources and you'd like to have it for certain reasons, and also that it's right at the border between China and India. Mm-hmm. And here we have some tensions and some rivalry going there. And maybe here we're straying into Indian politics. I just wonder, is the Dalai Lama's presence there in India, this has, you know, been going on for 50 years, but is that presence, does that pose any kind of a serious problem for relations between China and India?
I wouldn't say a serious problem. I mean, the Dalai Lama has been there since 1959. And I think that the problems would exist without him. I think the Chinese concern is less the fact that the Dalai Lama is in India and more a concern over the border. You know, so the Dalai Lama left in 1959 and the China-India war was in 1962. I mean, it was just a couple years later and the border remains highly and hotly disputed. You know, it's a militarized border. There are no public border crossings, you know, between the two countries. And I think that doesn't have to do with the Dalai Lama's presence in India. That has to do with, you know, that's where we're talking security and strategy.
Yeah. As you said, one of the things that if you asked Tibetan people what they would want to see, one of the things that they would really want to see would be to see the Dalai Lama come home.
Exactly.
Although it seems sort of hard to believe, it seems hard to believe that the Chinese would even let him visit, much less actually let him go back and live in Tibet. Do you think that we would ever see such a thing? That is, that they would say, okay, come home, and that he would move back into the Potala in Lhasa again?
I hope so. I mean, this is my wish, my dream, my fervent hope, along with every single Tibetan I personally know, and I presume probably almost every single one I don't know. And I think you have to be an optimist, or at least I'm an optimist, you know, working on this issue, that the Dalai Lama will be able to return to Tibet someday. Let me tell you the one thing that I think really complicates it, however, and it's past history. So at the end of the kind of Cultural Revolution, one of the delegations that was sent from Dharamsala, from India, of Tibetans to China, was allowed to go to Tibet. And this was a delegation that included the Dalai Lama's brother and sister. And the Chinese government thought that they had done such a good job turning Tibetans into socialists that they actually ordered everyone to go out and said, you know, go out, be on the street, be polite when they come by. You know, be nice to them. Because they thought that as good socialists, Tibetans were going to kind of protest or spit on them or be rude to, you know, these former, you know, serf owners and feudal religious leaders or whatnot. And they believed that so much that the Chinese government was absolutely shocked when Tibetans came out of every single corner and out of every cave and under every rock in Tibet and came and wept and threw themselves, you know, at the procession of the Dalai Lama's family members to ask about him and to try and touch them and to try and grab off a piece of their clothing because it was that close, the closest they could get to the Dalai Lama. Yeah. And what the Chinese realized in that moment was that they had not been able to quash the Tibetan spirit and that Tibetan religious cultural passion had roots that were deeper, you know, than socialism could probably ever dislodge. Yeah.
Well, there we'll finish up. Our guest, Carol McGranahan, she's cultural anthropologist, historian. She specializes in contemporary Tibet. She's on faculty at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And Professor McGranahan, thanks very much for talking.
Thank you. My pleasure.